Good evening. Well, we talked a little bit last week about chapter 11. But I would like to go back to it. This is the one with the strange story of Uchiyama Roshi's wound and how he lived with it. And though I think there's a great deal of wisdom in what he says about it, I also think there's a whole nother side that is not being included at all. And that I think it's important to bring up both sides. So it's called Living Through the Life of the Self. So he starts out with a discussion of the Tenzo, that other people are not like me. If I don't do this job, who's going to do it? And the Tenzo was very, very old, and Dogen didn't think he had to do it. He could get somebody to go and put the mushrooms out in the blazing sun and take good, better care of himself. And the old guy said, no, this is my job. So Uchiyama Roshi is taking this as a sign to sacrifice the self for the sake of whatever one's job is. And that's certainly what we understand from the Dharma, from the Buddha's teachings. Often it's said the Bodhisattva's life is very hard, and that the Bodhisattva sacrifices her life for the sake of all beings and is willing to step off, you know, the highest cliff in order to save someone. But there is the other side of the self that how can I say? Just been reading the Gargina, and there are always two sides that end up compromising each other and eradicating the two-sidedness of things. And so when he says no matter what circumstances we fall into, we have no real choice but to live through it by ourselves. We can't even exchange so much as a fart with another human being. And this is a very telling statement that Kodo Suwaki made and everybody uses to explain that we are completely independent of everything. Our life is life. And it's the only life as far as we are concerned. But that's just one side. And so he says, all too often people have grown so accustomed to living in a society of trade and compromise that even regarding their very own lives, they walk around in a fantasy world wondering if someone will come along to give them a hand. What else can we call this sort of suspension of reality other than fantasy? He says, this fantasizing is a way of avoiding the reality of the unfortunate circumstances that we have to deal with. And we also feel we're fighting a losing battle. Once we begin to wish that someone would come along to get us out of our mess, we start fantasizing all the more, and our situation looms even darker. He says, as difficult as it may seem to be, the highest ultimate truth in life is grounded in the fact that there are no favorable or adverse circumstances, no fortune or misfortune. All there is the life of the self. There's the famous story in Zen about the monk who was accused of having made a baby with a young girl. A young girl accused him. And when the baby was born, the parents picked up the baby and marched to the temple and gave it to the monk and said, "Here, it's yours." And he said, "Is that so?" And he took the baby and took care of it. And then she confessed finally that it was somebody else, and they came back and took the baby away. And he also said, "Is that so?" and accepted it. I don't think we really live like this. I don't think it's realistic or helpful in many ways. That the compassion side is missing, I think, in Uchiyama Roshi's approach to this. He wasn't compassionate even to himself. He just endured his suffering. And that we are utterly separate in the way he describes is one side. The other side is we are completely connected in every way. And that we are being helped continually in every way. And that to ignore that is to ignore the essence of our life and practice. That so many things that are happening to us we take for granted, but that would make our life impossible if they didn't exist. Every little thing that goes on with us is a gift. And without recognizing the gift and working with the gift and being that compassion, as the world is compassionately taking care, we too are compassionately taking care. And the more that we're aware of that, the more equanimity exists. So there are no favorable or adverse circumstances in on the emptiness side, you could say. On the emptiness side, that the world is as it is, and life and death are just life and death. But if we don't settle down and really study life and death and wisdom and compassion in terms of form, that without form, emptiness doesn't mean anything. And without emptiness, form doesn't mean anything. It's just the same. And there's a tendency, and I think an old monk like Uchiyama, whose whole focus is living a life of a sort of holy life, in a way, very limited kind of life, small life in a temple, that maybe his view was more on the emptiness side, and he was encouraging his monks to be good bodhisattvas and endure whatever comes up. But as a woman and a mother, I would say that letting your body go into a terrible fever and not doing anything about it is a mistake. It's an illusion. that the body itself is a precious thing. And it is the compassion, it is the activity, the action and the life of the Dharma. So it should be cared for especially carefully. And of course he didn't have anyone to take care of him except an elderly lady, but he doesn't give her much credit. It's like he was the hero and he managed it all, but I think if she was giving him licorice bulbs and wrapping things in paper and making him all better, that compassion was taking care of him whether he actually appreciated it or understood it at all. And I think it's well to remember that our life is like this, especially as Zen practitioners, so-called. He talks about the separation from the reality of life appearing as suffering and struggling. And certainly, it is struggling and suffering. That was Buddha's whole concern. But Buddha's concern was not about a stubbed toe that gets infected. It wasn't that kind of suffering that he was talking about. He was talking about the self-clinging side, the side that we set up in ourselves of mistaken thinking that we ourselves are some particular thing that will never change and that we ourselves are everlasting. And certainly that isn't true. It's why we sit. We sit to see through the illusion of the self. As we sit, we see so many ideas going by, and a lot of them are all about me. You know, what I think and what I want and what I don't want and where I went and where I'm going to go and all the fascinating things that are going on in my life. And we have to see that's what our brain is doing all the time, even though we're quietly sitting somewhere. And in that view, that the reality of that, that's the reality that we can see is ephemeral and unreal. So that when we encounter the world, you could say, the other, you could say, from our special self, we know that we're not a special self. We are entirely ourself with our own little parts, but at the same time, we are everyone at the same time. Zen can get very special. And I get a little irritated sometimes when it gets so special. I think it's really important that we stay in the world and keep our feet on the ground and on the wet sidewalk and are in and out of other people's houses and taking care of them, giving them poultices of licorice or whatever it is that we have to offer, and at least taking care of ourselves in a way that we can be of use in the world and of use in our own life, to create it in a way that can be an enjoyment for ourselves and for everyone around us. Life is short. And we tend to get distracted. So sitting is the clue and the solution. So we kind of try to wake up over and over again. He ends this by saying, no matter what happens to us in our lives, there is no real alternative other than to live through it then and there by ourselves. This is an inescapable reality. I cannot imagine anything more important in our lives than to completely resolve ourselves to the absolute nature of this truth. Certainly true. But I'm finding in my life, for instance, and maybe that's why I'm thinking about this now, is because my condition makes it hard to get around. And I am helped all the time. All over San Jose, wherever I go, people are opening doors. People are picking things up for me. And I don't ask for anything. I'm just charging along, right? Without really thinking about it, and somebody will be right there just when I need them. And some lady came right up behind me with an umbrella in the rain. She said, here's an umbrella. I always let the rain just rain on me. I love it. But she wanted me to be dry, and she made me get under the umbrella. Oh! And I know this doesn't happen all the time. I know people lead very, very difficult and fraught lives. But I think there's a whole lot more help around than we know, and that we are even giving that we know. And it's well to be aware and remember. So that's my little kind of preachy thing. But thank you, Uchiyama Roshi. He said if he had money or a wife or his parents, he wouldn't have suffered. So that's true. And he's absolutely right that if we're in a bad place and we can't do anything about it, that's the best thing to do is just to do it. So there's lots of time for questions or comments. Carolyn?
I appreciate giving the context, because I think it's, in reading through this book again, I feel like he does actually kind of see both sides, like in the next chapter, but mm-hmm. he emphasizes one side, and he's just got such a dynamic, forceful way of putting it. But the context that he's generalizing, it's language, but of speaking to a small group of monks, and you know, small groups tend to get, and then people will, not show up or not take their responsibility. So I think he does point that out, but it is within a certain context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he does see the other side as well. It's just sometimes he's on this story and sometimes he's on another. And this one, I agree. There seemed to be a little pridefulness in this mm-hmm. this particular chapter, especially because he not only told the story, but then he wrote a poem about it.
Yes.
So it was like, okay, look what I've gone through. You got, but you know, it's kind of like parents in a way. You kids don't know what you're
doing. How I've suffered.
Oh, the great me.
What it was like when we were.
Yeah.
Uphill both ways in the snow.
Yeah, or uphill both ways. Snow now. We moved to California. You kids could grow up.
Yes, yes. You don't know what it's like.
I don't know what it's like.
Walking miles to school in the snow.
But the gratitude, he doesn't talk as much about gratitude as other people do.
Yes.
But he does. I mean, but the fact that he also is living with us now. We're reading his book.
He is intimate friend.
Yes. You know, and in a way, I feel like some of these books we read over and over again, like you become acquainted with the people, and they are like your friends. You just shine a little different light on them.
Yeah. Yeah. John?
Just a question. Do you think this could be part of this ego that even a man with his development has an ego, and it manifests in a spiritual materialistic fashion? Maybe I don't remember the shades, but ideas about that sort of thing, you know, just he's doing this and he's really accomplishing and gaining and suffering and bringing on and all that sort of thing. Is it ego that you all have? Even when you get into spiritual practice, you have different forms of that ego clinging. Is that true?
I don't like to think about ego so much. It's an idea, a thing that isn't real. It's a proposition about how the self is put together. And I'd rather say it's the selfish self or the self-involved self or something like that rather than ego, because that seems like a big, thick thing that actually exists somewhere. And the self doesn't really exist. It's just the impulse to protect ourselves and identify ourselves as something in particular when that's not real. And to cling to aspects of what we think is the best of ourself and try to be that and project that when in fact we're sometimes very wise and brilliant and sometimes utter idiots. So it's more like that than it is. And teachers tend to get that way because teachers get projected on all over the place. And it's part of the job in a way to offer that projection and also to eliminate it in people at the same time. And so it's a very tricky business. And you can imagine that and we already know of many cases where it was teachers misappropriated their position and misused it with their students. It's very tempting to actually start, sitting up and glowing in the glow of everybody's attention or something. And it's hard to stay modest and humble and very important. So it is a problem. It's everybody's problem. We all have situations where we think we're the cat's meow, and other situations where we feel so ashamed and so bad. So, and at the same time, it's just us. It's just whatever it is. So equanimity is the thing, is to simply keep trusting ourselves and our world, our life and our world. It goes together.
I'm reminded that the Buddha could have toughed it out a little longer. He didn't have to eat that rice. He didn't have to just relax. Then where would we be?
Yeah, right. That's right. It was time. Yeah. Yes. Well, wisdom is running all through the whole situation, whether we like it or not. And often, what we find as our path has come through the wisdom that runs through us, and we don't always even appreciate it very much. So I think it's well to remember that we are where we've been brought in that way. And this place is what brought us here. Howsoever. Lots of so much gratitude for our great good fortune in so many ways.
On that note, I'd like to give a note of gratitude to a teacher whose life ended. Yeah, I guess yesterday, Stephen Levine.
Yes.
And it was just prior to my joining the Sangha that I sat with the Wednesday group, and our book that we were reading was of the life of the year.
Oh, yes.
And it encouraged me, or inspired me to do some journal writing for that year. And it was really a wonderful, it catapulted or created a trajectory that is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, when I read about it today on the news, I felt terribly like I was really missing somebody.
Yes, it's a loss.
Yeah.
A great loss. Yeah. He gave so much.
Yeah, I YouTubed a few pieces, and I was really struck by the compassion.
Yes.
The Maha Karuna.
Mm-hmm.
It was so obvious.
Yes.
Both he and his wife did a marvelous job working with the dying.
Yeah. And his son is a teacher also. Noah?
Yes.
Noah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, he's left a that legacy as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Gee, Jeffrey, I think I'm going to look at the news you read. It's better than Google News or CNN.
It is. It's a lot better. Yeah.
It's not on my radar. What site is it?
Oh, that's Lion's Roar.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, it's Buddhist News.
It's the Shambhala thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Where you share Joan Sutherland's talk on enlightenment. Yes. That
probably.
Was the site. That was the site.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's just about 8, and we have a meeting that I hope everybody can help us with. And I hope it's going to be brief, because I think nobody wants a long meeting. But it's very interesting. So
I have an announcement. Jikochi would like to know who's coming up to the Nehani Sesshin a month from today, February 19th to the 26th. Angie will be the guiding teacher. But they are the ones that are putting it on, so you need to contact them if you plan on going.
Can you email us the information for it? Just like I don't know their website or anything. I'm just sorry. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Their website would be the best way to connect.
I think there's a link. There's a link to it from the events page on photos and the
excellent.
Oh, to the announcement, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
You're
great.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's really nice. Super. Well, let's do our 1 minute sit.